Madam Chair, panel.
I act for C18 and C19, as you may recall. Both were sexually abused by Benedictine monks at Benedictine schools attached to Benedictine abbeys. Not Downside or Ampleforth, as it happens, but their experience was similar to those that you have heard in evidence before you, and the reasons for it are the same. May I outline my submissions? They are these. First, that the English Benedictine congregation has proved itself incapable of self-governance to protect children in its care. The reasons matter. We reject the reasons offered by the Benedictine monks, the excuses that have been presented before you. We emphasise the very real impediments to self-governance presented by Catholic teaching, canon law, the rules of the Benedictine order, the hierarchical structure of the English Benedictine congregation, its culture, and its unincorporated status. Those reasons, we suggest, will inform the recommendations you are minded to make in your inquiry. We recommend, in summary, the creation of a failure to report offence, with no exception for the confessional, the creation of a failure to protect offence, the extension of the position of trust offences that currently exist under the Sexual Offences Act 2005, and the creation of a new statutory body with powers to police and enforce basic standards of child protection. We envisage such a body being akin to the Health and Safety Executive. And finally, we recommend a review of the powers and operation of the Charity Commission. Some of those recommendations have featured in the Australian Royal Commission report published today. Now, my first submission, that the English Benedictine congregation is incapable of self-governance. We say that the evidence has shown clearly that the congregation has failed to implement appropriate child safeguarding over decades. Those failures have persisted post-Nolan, post-Cumberledge, post-Carlisle. In 2010, on a review of the Downside files, concerns were raised in relation to 16 out of the 23 monks at Downside. The failures persist now, even in the face of this inquiry. Children are still at risk at Downside and Ampleforth, according to their own former abbot and headmaster, Aidan Bellinger, writing as recently as the 1st of July 2017, in a letter he never expected to be made public. He wrote, RCF77's attitudes are perverse and criminal, and he should not be allowed to reside at Downside. His case parallels that of RCF18 at Ampleforth. It is clear that James Whitehead felt that his recent departure, or impending departure, was related to his actions in relation to safe child safeguarding. Those failures have not only exposed children to the risk of abuse, they have, in a number of cases, been directly responsible for further abuse. The English Benedictine congregation has failed for reasons that may prove common to other institutions you will investigate. But it is also clear that it has failed for reasons that are peculiar to the English Benedictine congregation. Let me first reject the various excuses offered by the clerics who came before you, that times were different and social standards were different. Nobody took it that seriously. That they were naive. That we are judging them with the benefit of hindsight. That child safeguarding measures were not as highly developed in the past as they are now. That record keeping and filing in the past was poor. Well, all those things may be true. But they are not the reasons why the Benedictines failed. A case which we say pays particular attention is that of Anselm Hirt, because it is a case that spans decades. We know from that case that social standards were not different then. We know that because the headmaster in 1970, Aylred Watkin, reacted immediately to the disclosure of Anselm Hirt's abuse by dismissing him and reporting him with full details to the statutory authority. We know that a parent at the time wrote to the abbot in these terms because she was concerned that Hirt was preying upon her 15-year-old son in 1970, even after his dismissal. And I will provide the reference in written submissions, but it reads like this. We were told by Father Watkin the real reason for the dismissal. This man is amoral and evil. He is a member of your community, and you must take some responsibility for him. Father Passmore, if harm comes to my son, I shall find it very hard indeed to forgive you. These offences were as repugnant to right-thinking people then as now. There were no elaborate safeguarding protocols in 1970. Yet a statutory authority was informed, and at least one parent was told why. The views of the headmaster were clear, that Hirt should not work in a school or youth club or anything of that character in future. All this in 1970. The monks in charge were not naive then. They were not naive later. They are not naive now. Over the course of the next 40 years, the monastery reintegrated this monk Hirt into society and finally into monastic and priestly life. It's a process of reintegration that took place at the same time as child safeguarding awareness and policies developed. Hirt was looked after. It was a cradle-to-grave service. The abbot provided references for various jobs. Those jobs included, and again I shall provide references in writing, trainee child care officer and probation officer, the job description for which read, a job that involved supervision of offenders of all ages, as well as young people who, because of their home circumstances, need special care. Hirt wrote to the abbot, thanking him for one such glowing reference. He felt bold enough to ask that he would be grateful if you did not raise the matter of the ban on teaching, as this could naturally complicate things and possibly weigh against me in a competitive selection. Hirt was provided with money. Indeed, his last letter to the abbot was in 1974 to ask for money to buy a house. With the support of a Catholic psychiatrist, Dr. Seymour, commissioned and paid for by the abbot, he eventually overturned his ban on teaching. It seems he got a job in Liverpool, married, and had children. Stage one of his reintegration was complete. This was not naivety. The abbot knew what the headmaster's view was, because it had been clearly communicated and copied to him. Stage two began with Abbot Charles and Hirt's reintegration into monastic life in the 1990s. It is particularly telling that the chief reason when you piece together the correspondence, that Hurt was prevented from returning to Downside was the continued presence of Aylward Watkin, the headmaster who had originally dismissed him. The same man who said Hurt should not be let near children. That tells you that the much vaunted change of atmosphere at Downside, heralded by Abbot Charles, was as much about tolerating known paedophiles in their midst than it was about, as he would put it, common humanity. Nor was the Abbot of Glenstall naive. He wanted to know about Hurt's past for the sake of the Abbey and their potential civil liability, not the safety of children. He wrote in 1994, "I have just attended a series of meetings on the whole topic of child abuse by the clergy," as long ago as that. "And the insurance implications, quite apart from more exalted considerations, are horrendous." Abbot Charles reviewed the file and sent it. He had no problem accessing records from 20 years before. In reply, the Abbot of Glenstall said he would destroy that which was specifically damaging to Anselm, as some letter from Rome recommends. That was pure cynicism. A cynicism that did not receive any reproach or comment from Abbot Charles. On the contrary, Abbot Charles sought to suggest to you at this inquiry that the proposed action by the Abbot of Glenstall was entirely appropriate. The baton passed to Abbot Yeo. Yeo remembered Hurt from his schoolboy days, and then as a postulant, as someone with an engaging personality. In April 2001, he supported his return to the priesthood. He was free to perform all the sacraments and would be most welcome to visit at Downside. Yeo supported the return without any knowledge of what Hurt had done for the last 30-odd years. In July of that year, Abbot Yeo was elected Abbot President. In September 2001, the final Nolan Report was published with its final recommendations. You will recall counsel to the inquiry taking him to those recommendations. Recommendation 69, important to treat current allegations about abuse that took place some years ago in exactly the same way as allegations of current abuse. Recommendation 70, bishops and religious superiors should ensure that any cases which were known in the past but not acted on satisfactorily should be the subject of review as soon as possible, reported to the statutory authorities wherever appropriate, and that there is appropriate follow-up action, including possibly regular continuous assessment. Those were recommendations which Yeo said he supported. But he said this did not cause him to reflect on what he had just done for Anselm Hurt. We invite you to reject that. He clearly did reflect on it. He knew what he should do. He deliberately failed to do it. And so we have, over the course of 40 years, a known abusive monk that had been kicked out of the monastery gradually reintegrated back into the fold in an abbey with a school and with no restrictions on his activities. What happened with Anselm Hurt was not naivety, it was cynicism. It is not judging the Benedictines with the unfair benefit of hindsight. Watkin did not welcome this man's presence back to Downside from the time he dismissed him until his death. The monks that came after knew what they should have done at the time and flatly refused to have done it. It wouldn't have mattered what safeguarding guidance was in place or how much training they had. They would have always refused to follow it. And we reject the excuse that the records were inadequate. Abbot Charles told you, "I think monasteries generally are rather keen on archives, so things don't get thrown away. I would say the files are pretty complete, at least with what has been given to be filed." Now, he had no difficulty finding Hurt's records from 20 years before. The problem with the records is not that they are incomplete or don't exist. The problem is that they are filed in an opaque way to prevent outsiders accessing them. And of course, there's not much to be done if records are deliberately destroyed or if the filing system is opaque. No one is unlikely to forget the evidence of Leo Davis and how he barrowed loads of monks' files to a distant wood to burn them over the course of several days. These are highly educated men, all from very similar backgrounds. Top public schools, top universities, white, upper middle class. They ran large estates and large enterprises. These are not unworldly men. These were monks who should, as a body, have helped lead the way. In many cases, they did not even follow. They were following a script of their own. Some, like Yeo, paid lip service to child safeguarding. Some, like Timothy Wright, did not even do that. Some, like Cuthbert Madden, made seeming efforts. But as Adrian Child said, in respect of essentially voluntary guidance, a lot of this seems based on the integrity of individuals. Even where progress was made, it was dependent on the skills and expertise of the coordinator and the doggedness in the endeavour of the abbot. What abbot, with any sense of responsibility in relation to a known abuser in his community, would write, as Charles Fitzgerald Lombard wrote in 1997, "I am hopeful that the climate among our national witch hunters will be sufficiently muted for him," meaning Nicholas White in this case, "to take up a strictly monastic residence again." If that is what these monks are prepared to put in writing, to what depths of cynicism do they descend between themselves on the telephone and in the refectory? Fitzgerald Lombard, Yeo and Wright did not act with integrity. Men of faith, they acted in bad faith. Better men may come, but what if they do not? I turn to the real reasons for the failings. And the primary reason is this. A, the lack of accountability of those responsible for the welfare of children. And two, the conflict of interest that inevitably arises when those in charge are responsible for the welfare of children and potential perpetrators. Now, those are reasons that are likely to be typical for a number of the institutions you investigate. But there are features of this particular manifestation of the Catholic Church that show how intractable the solution is likely to be. The first is what these men believe. And we shouldn't think they don't. They really do believe. According to the rule of St. Benedict, the abbot is believed to hold the place of Christ in the monastery. And the abbot must never teach or decree or command anything that would deviate from the Lord's instructions. You remember Abbot Charles said that apart from the Almighty, he did not answer to anyone. Even the abbot president was limited in his power over the abbot. We have heard how the abbot's first task before all else is the care of his monks. When Abbot Wright had the temerity to challenge the paramountcy principle, he was merely stating the truth, that monks come before children. Mr. Steen has referred to Canon Law 489 in relation to the destruction of documents in criminal cases in matters of morals after 10 years. You have seen the letter from Abbot Dillon, who appears to have received a standing instruction from Rome to destroy documents damaging to monks. You have heard about the absolute seal of the confessional. Even when a child tells a priest in confession that he, she has been sexually abused and it's not their sin. The seal protects abusers and encourages them to abuse. And you can infer from the evidence of A221, that's the boy at Downside abused by Richard White, and that of Richard Yeo, when I asked questions of him, that these monks confess their sexual abuse to their fellow monks in real time, and did so repeatedly as they carried on abusing. They had to, because the principal function of the priest is to celebrate Mass and take the Eucharist, and they can't do that unless they've had absolution from a grave sin. So it follows that this was essentially an offence committed and reported in real time, and an open secret in this closed community. Richard Yeo himself told us that there was sufficient concern that there were elements of Catholic theology that might tend to encourage abusive behaviour that the EBC sponsored a conference about it. And you'll remember that his own particular concern was that there was something in the nature of the priesthood deriving from the fact that according to Catholic theology there is an ontological effect on the person on becoming a priest that may have created an atmosphere where child sexual abuses, he wouldn't say facilitated, but made less unlikely. It is exactly the same concern raised by the United Nations when it wrote in 2014, "The committee reiterates its concern about the Holy See's reservations to the Convention, which undermine the full recognition of children as subject of rights and condition the application of the Convention on its compatibility with the sources of law of Vatican City State." That is what these men believe. The second reason is the hierarchical structure of the English Benedictine congregation, the harmful concentration of power in one individual such that people like George Corey Prior did not feel able to challenge the abbot about child safeguarding. Abbot Timothy Wright was able to resist outside interference for an extended period. He recruited lawyers to help him to do so. We know that both Barry Honeysett and Mark White were hesitant to pursue their full powers in the face of such belligerent, I think, was Aidan Bellinger's. Am I being told that time is running out? Ma'am, the third reason is that the culture and traditions of the EBC, this was an old boys club. Once in, you were catered for life. They lived literally and not just figuratively like brothers. They ate together, they prayed together, celebrated Mass together. And a clear case of that operation of the old boys club is the case of Anselm Hurt. It's a club that came with very worldly benefits. You heard Jane Dulalovich tell you about Downside Abbey is absolutely beautiful. It is really beautiful, as is the school, and it has beautiful facilities, a beautiful environment. The monks' rooms are well furnished, they are very comfortable. Their private spaces are comfortable. There are plenty of private rooms within the abbey that are very comfortable. A job as an EBC monk came with high status. You were not just a priest, but a well-to-do pillar of the community. Aidan Bellinger was not above name-dropping famous politicians. Deference came automatically from parents who were effectively lay members of the same club. We heard how A221's father sought an injunction to prevent publicity as much for the church's sake as his son's, and was prepared to shake the hand of Father White even after he had learned about White's abuse of his son. To outsiders, this is often intimidating, and it clearly played its part in inhibiting decisive action by state authorities. And the final reason is the legal status of the EBC. They do not have a corporate structure. They cannot be held easily accountable. Yeo recognised himself when he said the only juridical persons associated with religious congregations in this country are the charitable trusts which hold the property of most of our congregations, and he saw this as a weakness. In conclusion, as to the reasons, we agree with Adrian Child when he said that he didn't see any value in tinkering around the edges. Three strikes, too many. This is the third opportunity to get it right. It cannot be left to the EBC or the Catholic Church. You heard me outline my recommendations earlier. Given the time, I'm not going to go through them in detail, but I shall put them in writing and you will see what we say, and have particular regard, I hope, to the Australian Commission's report, which came out today. Ma'am, thank you.